Hello, this is Mary Mortland reading the News Gazette Part 1 for Thursday, April 6, 2017. Prompt attention. University will be renting teleprompter for speakers at graduation. When Professor Christopher Benson stepped to the microphone as Master of Ceremonies for the University of Illinois Sesquicentennial Kickoff Celebration, he delivered his poetic opening remarks with barely a glance down at the podium. Benson, Chancellor Robert Jones, and President Tim Killeen were able to use a teleprompter for their speeches. For the first time in many years, the U of I rented the teleprompter from a Chicago company for the event, according to campus spokeswoman Robin Kaler. Jones is very comfortable with the teleprompter and suggested using them after he became chancellor, Kaler said. When you're giving long remarks, like at the sesquicentennial or commencement, you have to read them. It's not in anybody's best interest to have our CEO spend his time memorizing a 15-minute script, Kaler said. And you want the speaker to be looking at and connecting with the audience, not staring down at a piece of paper, she said. It's just not as engaging, she said. The presidential teleprompter used by U.S. presidents for decades are small glass mirrors mounted on stands to the left and right of the lectern. They display the text of a speech electronically for the speaker, but the audience sees only clear glass. A trained operator controls the flow of the text, practicing with the speakers and then sitting near the stage during the event so he can see and hear them and follow along, Kaler said. He can see if they're slowing down or stop if the audience laughs, she said. Benson practiced for about 5 minutes and was amazing, a total natural, Kaler said. The teleprompters are only used for big events, perhaps once or twice a year, she said. They will be in use again at the May 13th commencement ceremony at Memorial Stadium for a cost of about $1,175, Kaler said. That's a pretty special day. We want students to know we're concerned about them, she said. We don't want them to have their last memory to be the tops of the head of their leaders. Tense times after votes. Residents upset over outcome. One day after voters decided in favor of selling the Champaign County Nursing Home and against tripling the property tax to support the facility, county officials were planning their next moves. But at the nursing home, staff members were trying to comfort residents who were upset about the vote. The proposal to raise the property tax rate from about 3 cents per $100 of assessed valuation to 10 cents per $100 lost 55.9% to 44.1%. And a separate question authorizing the county board to sell or dispose of the nursing home was approved 54% to 46%. We had a few residents who were quite upset, said Karen Nofke, the administrator of the facility. We had residents in tears today. They're concerned that they're going to have to move. There's no plan to close the nursing home, officials insist, and any sale or transfer of the property is probably about a year away. But the facility's 160 or so residents and 200-plus employees are concerned, she said. We had members of our social services staff talk to them, Nofke said. A letter will go out today to nursing home residents and family members from County Administrator Rick Snyder and County Board Chairman C. Pius Weibel, aimed at explaining the process for disposing of the nursing home, she said. Snyder said his agenda also includes stabilization, management, and financing for the home, even before he can start working on its sale or transfer. Initially, we're going to want to focus on stabilization. I'll be meeting with employees over at the nursing home to explain what the vote meant Tuesday and how we plan to go forward from here, Snyder said. Also, we'll begin talking about the technical details of separating the property from the county so it can be sold or transferred to another entity. A big unknown. Jack Anderson, the county board member who also chairs the Nursing Home Advisory Board, said one of the first things he wants to do is work on consolidating sections of the facility. Nofke said that the process already has begun, but about 13 residents still need to be moved before one of the facility's wings could be closed. We need to do some consolidations in the building and cut some of our costs there. That won't place anybody outside of the home. We have enough vacancies that we can accomplish that, Anderson said. Then we'll have to present to the county board some other options and outline the financial impacts of those and the procedural process involved. He said that his primary concern is ensuring that the nursing home's financial problems don't spread to the rest of the county government. Everything we're doing over there is costing the county, and we need to make sure the sheriff has patrol cars and that we have people who work in the jail and that we can provide for inmates and that the coroner can do autopsies, Anderson said. The nursing home loses money every month to the tune of around $100,000 or so, plus its debt losses. The quicker we move on this, the more quickly we can stop the hemorrhaging and make it a little more manageable. Anderson reiterated that he doesn't want to see the nursing home closed. We've made it clear moving into this that it's never been our intention to close the nursing home. Whether the county operates it or a private entity or a nonprofit entity, the intent is to keep the nursing home operating. He said, at this point, there's no reason for anybody to think that their jobs are in jeopardy. But people are going to have their concerns, and I can only assuage them so much. The reality is that there's a big unknown out there as this moves forward. Very complicated. Snyder said he also needs to begin planning for the facility's interim management and its financial future. A contract with the home's private management company expires June 30th and is unlikely to be renewed, and it's not likely a single manager can be found for what is likely a short-term job, he said. We'll be talking about options, Snyder said. Financially, he said, the county needs to reduce the home's accounts payable, which stood at $3.3 million in January. Both he and Anderson said that time is running out for the county to try to set up a nonprofit organization, which had been suggested in February by consultant Ron Aldridge. It's not too late, but it's very complicated. It's kind of like management by committee, because you're going to have a lot of interests in there. It won't be one nonprofit. As I understand it, the thought is it would be a consortium of nonprofits, Anderson said. I'm not opposed to that, but it has some inherent issues. There'll be so many overlapping interests and responsibilities in such an arrangement, it would take a long legal document to figure that one out. Snyder said any such arrangement would have to be initiated by county board members and would have to be worked on pretty quickly to remain a viable option. An analysis of the vote of the nursing home question shows that most Champaign and Urbana precincts were pro-nursing home, both for the tax increase and against the sale. But in the rural areas of the county, the vote was solidly the other way. In Ogden 2, a precinct that votes at the Royal Community Building, nearly 90% of voters opposed the tax increase, and 92.5% favored selling the nursing home. Plan to remodel hotel has support. Survey of local businesses finds 80% in favor. Alderman Dennis Roberts took to the streets to find out what downtown business owners and employees think about a possible deal to redevelop the Landmark Hotel into a Hilton Tapestry Boutique Hotel, which would cost the city $9.5 million in post-construction bonds. Developer Crimson Rock Capital is on track to remodel Landmark as it stands for $19 million, but only if the city pitches in its part. Of the downtown business people surveyed, Roberts said 80% want the building preserved and restored, while 2% want it torn down and rebuilt from scratch. 13% were unsure of either option. Since the downtown area is in the district he represents, Roberts said he wanted to gather opinions for the city council to keep in mind when deciding whether to approve the deal. Between March 23rd and March 27th, he said, he surveyed 54 people who represented 39 businesses. The answers were anonymous and categorized by block, street, or building. Specifically, Roberts said he surveyed businesses on the north and south side of Main Street, from Birch Street to Broadway Avenue, and on Race and Broadway from Boneyard Creek South to Elm Street. He said he tried to speak to owners as much as possible, but he also gathered opinions from managers and employees. Roberts tapped businesses of all stripes, including retail, law, agency, banking, postal, restaurant, and some in Lincoln Square Mall. He asked them if they live in Urbana, if they're familiar with the restoration proposition, if they thought restoration would help the downtown area and or their business, and if they knew about the city's share of the money. None refused to comment, and many were aware of the proposed deal, Roberts said. noting that he observed emotions ranging from anxiety to great affection for the hotel. These are common paraphrased comments from survey respondents, according to Roberts. A renovated hotel would be an important catalyst for downtown, repeated 17 times. A renovated hotel would bring needed foot traffic to downtown or Lincoln Square Mall, repeated 21 times. A renovated hotel would bring students to the University of, from the University of Illinois campus to downtown, repeated 5 times. Hilton is important as a quality brand, repeated 11 times. I support renovation with some type of new hotel brand, repeated 10 times. A similar opportunity is unlikely to come again, repeated twice. Hotel's historic character and historic significance could be should be preserved, repeated 10 times. The current offer is too expensive, repeated twice. No strong opinions, repeated 4 times. Roberts said he also found that some business people had misinformation or misconceptions about the redevelopment proceedings. He said a lot of respondents through the city would be thought the city would be paying $9.5 million up front and taking it from the general fund. Rather, the city would be paying for 20 years after the hotel is open and operating, and the money would come from increased hotel motel tax revenue, restaurant and liquor sales from the hotel's restaurant and cafe, and a higher value for the hotel's property tax assessment income. In addition, some respondents said the hotel's current owner is asking for too much by putting Landmark on sale for $5 million after buying it for $600,000 about 5 years ago. Since the hotel has been vacant for 2 years and didn't live up to standards the owner initially promised, respondents said the city shouldn't allow that sale price. Roberts said that the transaction is a private negotiation between the seller and potential buyer, so the city can't be directly involved. In the case of Peoria's Pere Marquette Hotel, which was built by Landmark's proposed architect, Campo Architects, and was foreclosed on by one of its biggest investors, Robert said Urbana could avoid similar legal trouble with Landmark. Peoria unwisely entered into a joint mortgage agreement and became partial investors responsible for repayment of the hotel, Robert said, noting that the hotel wasn't developed by Crimson Rock. We're not going to do that or acquire Landmark by eminent domain because we don't want to own or manage the hotel. We don't want to be stuck with a project that fails. New documents on the proposed Landmark deal will be released by the city today, and the council will meet and continue discussions on it on Monday. Doing something about it. Students started textbook library to help cut costs. Tuition isn't the only thing becoming increasingly pricey in higher education. Crystal Bates knows firsthand that cash-strapped students can have a tough time affording textbooks, too. Now she's doing something about it. A single Tolono mom and Parkland College student, Bates is establishing a free textbook lending library at Parkland, and she's seeking help from current and former students to donate their former textbooks so the library can grow. Drop off any Parkland textbook you're willing to part with, she urged. A 35-year-old mother of three, Bates is set to graduate from Parkland in May in social work. She served as a student trustee on the Parkland board for 2016-17 and argued against a tuition increase. Losing that battle really broke my heart. It took the wind out of my sails, she said. That is until she talked to her mom about it, and her mom's response was, "What are you going to do about it?" Bates recalled. Along came her idea for the textbook lending library. Tuition and textbooks are the most expensive part of campus life, and since students have no control over tuition, I believe the little lending library adds an answer to those expenses, she said. The library is being based at Parkland's Office of Student Life in Room U111. Book donations can be brought there during business hours on weekdays while Parkland is in session. The office is also open until 7 p.m. on Tuesdays. Donated textbooks are being cataloged, and students will be able to sign them out for a semester on the honor system. Students who damage or don't return textbooks won't be allowed to borrow any more until they return or replace the books, Bates said. She hopes to have enough books collected to have the library up and running for the start of the summer session. If not, then definitely for fall, she said. An avid reader interested in social justice, Bates said she has organized the library as a pledge project for the Parkland Service Fraternity, Alpha Phi Omega. She plans to leave it running in other hands after she leaves in the fall to pursue a bachelor's degree in political science at Colorado State University. Three facing gun charges. Two men allegedly involved in the attempted sale of guns from the back of a car were charged with weapons offenses. A third was also charged for not having a firearm owner's identification card. Champaign Police Sergeant Dave Griffith said police received information about 6:30 p.m. Monday that there were two armed men at a convenience store in the 300 block of Bloomington Road trying to sell a pistol and a rifle. Police made contact with them and found a loaded .22 caliber pistol at the rear on the rear floorboard and an uncased, unloaded rifle in the trunk. Police also found ammunition in the center console. They detained the men, Cameron Anderson, 18, of the 2400 block of Lakewood Drive, Champaign, and Ian Keyes, 24, of the 1600 block of Harper Drive, Rantoul. Keyes told police he had obtained the handgun in exchange for crack cocaine from a man in Effingham. He said he had no knowledge of the rifle in the trunk. The car belonged to Anderson, the report said. After talking to the pair, police obtained a search warrant for the home of Nicholas Hastings, 21, in the 1700 block of Hedge Road, Champaign. Anderson had told police that he and Hastings were friends. Hastings was not present when police searched about 11 p.m. They found a 12-gauge shotgun in a bedroom and several kinds of ammunition. About 90 minutes later, police were still in the area when they heard a loud noise from the back of the house. They found Hastings between his house and a neighbor's house. They also found a clothes dryer in the backyard that had a loaded handgun inside that had not been there when the police searched earlier. Keyes and Anderson were both charged Tuesday with aggravated unlawful use of weapons, a felony, while Hastings was charged with the misdemeanor possession of the shotgun without having a firearm owner's identification card. Arsons suspected in fires. Blaze destroys three vehicles. Authorities believe early morning fires Wednesdays that destroyed three vehicles in southeast Rantoul were intentionally set. Rantoul's fire chief, Ken Waters, said firefighters were called to the 800 block of St. Andrew Circle about 4:36 a.m. When we arrived, there were three vehicles fully involved with fire, Waters said. Arson is suspected in this instance. Waters said two vehicles were parked next to one another, and the third car was parked a little ways away from the others. He said what was used to start the fires is under investigation. They were fully involved when we got there, Waters said, adding the vehicles were totally destroyed. No structures were threatened by the fires, and the vehicles were parked in a parking lot a distance away from any buildings. Urbana man charged with burglarizing car. An Urbana man accused of burglarizing a car in Champaign about a month ago is due back in court next week for a probable cause hearing. Tevin Gunby, 24, who listed an address in the 1600 block of Willow Road, was arraigned Tuesday on burglary charges. He's alleged to have entered a car in the 800 block of Harvard Street on March 8th, intending to steal. Assistant State's Attorney Troy Lozar said a car owner saw two men inside his vehicle about 5 p.m. that day and yelled at them, and they ran off. Champaign police found 13 vehicles in that neighborhood had been entered. They lifted a fingerprint from one that matched Gunby. He was arrested Monday on an unrelated case and charged with a car burglary. Hearing that he had been released from prison in November and had prior convictions for possessing cannabis, a controlled substance, and a stolen vehicle, Judge Brett Olmstead set Gunby's bond at $35,000. Storm slam southeast. Tornado, winds, hail leave trails of damage, but no casualties. Atlanta. Severe storms raking the southeast unleashed one large tornado and more than a half dozen apparent twisters Wednesday, toppling trees, roughing up South Carolina's peach capital, and raining out golfers warming up for the Masters. A powerful tornado toppled trees and downed power lines in rural Georgia, and similar scenes played out in spots around Alabama and South Carolina amid drenching rain, high winds, and scattered hail, some as big as baseballs. The severe weather outbreak was the second to hit the South in less than a week, but no deaths or significant injuries were reported by Wednesday evening. Storms on Sunday and Monday killed five people, including a Mississippi woman who desperately called 911 from a car that plunged into a rain-swollen creek. Portions of Kentucky and Georgia were still under threat of tornadoes late Wednesday, and flash flooding was possible in the Atlanta area, according to the National Weather Service. Authorities in Johnston, South Carolina, a town of 2,300 that calls itself the peach capital of the world, reported a possible tornado there damaged about a dozen buildings. Crews couldn't immediately check nearby peach orchards, but authorities said they were already severely damaged by a late March hard freeze. Johnston Mayor Terrence Culbra said he opened a local armory as a shelter and that lights were out and many streets were blocked by fallen trees. Thousands had lost power across the three states Wednesday with utilities struggling to keep up. "We need power back," Culbra said by phone, "but there likely are more storms coming and they can't get the power back in bad weather." In southwest Georgia, a powerful tornado that touched down at midday traveled some distance on the ground in rural Stewart County, National Weather Service meteorologist Keith Stillman said. It left downed power lines and trees on roads, said Sandra James, a sheriff's office dispatcher. Elsewhere, a suspected tornado touched down in southeastern Alabama before crossing into Georgia, forecasters said. All told, at least 9 possible tornadoes have been reported across Alabama, Georgia, and South Carolina as the day wore on, with more reports likely as the storms continued into the evening. In Alabama, the storm hit an area dotted with vacation and full-time homes around Lake Eufaula, damaging some homes and knocking down power lines and trees, said official John Taylor with the Henry County Emergency Management Agency. He also reported no deaths or injuries there. Tornadoes weren't the only threat Wednesday. The nation's Storm Prediction Center said winds were blowing at near 70 miles per hour in some areas, downing the trees in several states. Alabama Governor Robert Bentley declared a state of emergency and deployed 50 National Guard soldiers. There also were multiple school closings in Alabama and many early dismissals in South Carolina. The Federal Aviation Administration temporarily halted flights to Atlanta's airport, but those later resumed with arrival and departure delays. As storms bore down on Augusta National, the venerable East Georgia Club shut down for the second time this week as golfers tried to get in some practice before the start of the Masters tournament later this week. Officials cut short the final afternoon practice and ordered rain-bedraggled fans to leave the course. Augusta National also closed Monday because of heavy rains. And the East Alabama city of Oxford, convenience store manager Don Copeland was working up courage to go outside and look at his truck after a storm dumped so much grape-sized hail the ground turned white. "It's a 2015. I just made a $550 payment this morning," Copeland said. The Weather Service said it has gotten reports of baseball-sized hail in the West Alabama town of Camden, but only small ice pellets fell at the McGaw Webb Chevrolet Incorporated. "Thank goodness we did not get that. We just had pea-sized hail, and two or three cars were damaged," said Evan Bohannon, who handles online sales for the dealership. In central Kentucky, Mike Callahan of the National Weather Service in Louisville said some areas received large amounts of hail Wednesday evening, some of it several inches deep. The hydrologist also reported winds up to 72 miles an hour in places. Evidence mounting of nerve gas usage. U.S. and world leaders claim Assad to blame. Diplomats at the U.N. Security Council sparred Wednesday over whether to hold President Bashar Assad's government responsible for a chemical weapons attack that killed more than 80 people in northern Syria, while U.S. intelligence officials, Doctors Without Borders, and the U.N. Health Agency said evidence pointed to nerve gas exposure. The Trump administration said, and other world leaders said, the Syrian government was to blame. But Moscow, a key ally of Assad, said the assault was caused by a Syrian airstrike that hit a rebel stockpile of chemical arms. Early U.S. assessments showed the use of chlorine gas and traces of the nerve agent sarin in the attack Tuesday that terrorized the Syrian town of Khan Sheikhoun, according to two U.S. officials who weren't authorized to speak publicly on the matter and demanded anonymity. Israeli military intelligence officers also believe Syrian government forces were behind the attack. Israeli defense officials told the Associated Press Israel believes Assad has tons of chemical weapons still in the arsenal, despite a concerted operation 3 years ago by the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons to rid the government of its stockpile and the officials who spoke on condition of anonymity because they weren't authorized to brief the media. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan also blamed the Syrian government for the attack. In Khan Shaykhun, rescue workers found terrified survivors still hiding in shelters as another wave of airstrikes battered the town Wednesday. Those strikes appeared to deliver only conventional weapons damage. Among those discovered alive were two women and a boy found hiding in a shelter beneath their home, the Civil Defense Research and Rescue Group told the AP. The effects of the attack overwhelmed the hospitals around the town, leading paramedics to send patients to medical facilities across rebel-held areas in northern Syria, as well as to Turkey. The Turkish Health Ministry said three victims died receiving treatment inside its borders. The Britain-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights Monitoring Group put the toll at 86 killed. Victims of the attack showed signs of nerve gas exposure, the World Health Organization and Doctors Without Borders said, including suffocation, foaming at the mouth, convulsions, constricted pupils, and involuntary defecation. Paramedics were using fire hoses to wash the chemicals from the bodies of victims. Medical teams also reported smelling bleach on survivors of the attack, suggesting chlorine gas was also used, Doctors Without Borders said. The magnitude of the attack was reflected in the images of the dead, children piled in heaps for burial, a father carrying his lifeless young twins. The visuals from the scene were reminiscent of a 2013 nerve gas attack of the suburbs of Damascus that left hundreds dead and prompted an agreement brokered by the United States and Russia to disarm Assad's chemical stockpile. Western nations blamed government forces for that attack, where effects were concentrated in opposition-held areas. At the Vatican, Pope Francis said during his general audience that he is watching with horror at the latest events in Syria and that he strongly deplored the unacceptable massacre. Tuesday's attack happened just 60 miles from the Turkish border. Trump mum on reprisals. His expression grave and his words empathetic, President Donald Trump declared on Wednesday the deadly chemical attack in Syria had crossed many, many lines and abruptly changed his views of Syrian President Bashar Assad, but he refused to say what the U.S. might do in response. Trump issued no ultimatums in comments that were being scoured by world leaders for signs of how the new president would react to a global crisis. In a rare reversal of rules, Trump was more reserved than many of his top advisors, including his U.N. envoy, who strongly hinted some U.S. action was coming. Trump himself was noncommittal. "I'm not saying I'm doing anything one way or another, but I'm certainly not going to be telling you," he told the reporters. He blamed the attack squarely on Assad's forces, though the embattled Syrian leader and his Russian backers denied it. He suggested that the assault had killed 72 people had diminished his former reluctance to plunge the United States further into the complex and dangerous turmoil in the Middle East. "When you kill innocent children, innocent babies, little babies, with a gas that is so lethal, people were shocked to hear what gas it was that crosses many, many lines," Trump said in the White House Rose Garden. U.S. officials said the gas was likely chlorine with traces of a nerve agent like sarin. This has been Mary Mortland reading the News Gazette Part 1 for Thursday, April 6, 2017. Please stay tuned for Part 2.